last night of classes. So, we wanted to have kind of a last week. We finished up the Book of Esther last week, as you guys probably remember. But we've done it twice, so now this has become a real custom of Shoresh to kind of end with a special shir, a special class, just kind of giving us some broad ideas of the entire book. We're going to have just a food siyum on Friday. Hopefully you got the email from Rebecca Mahom in the apartment for breakfast. Send that a reminder shortly.
But, and am I invited back
for
that?
Yeah, you're definitely welcome to come back to that. But we did want to end with a special shiur, so we're very happy Rabbi Sinensky could join us. Rabbi Sinensky is the Rosh Beit Midrash, the head of the Beit Midrash over at Kohelet Yeshiva High School over in Lower Merion, short 20-minute drive from here. Previously he served as the rabbi of the Albert Einstein Shul and the Albert Einstein Medical School. Studied Yeshiva University, was in their dance kolo there, and also is Greek from Israeli. And it's really gotten to know him for a couple years now. And
you've read up on me.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, I did my research.
What else did I do?
had the privilege of knowing him for 4 years. He was the camp rabbi in more.
I worked for my wife.
Somehow he was.
I worked for my wife actually at one point.
Right. If anyone was at the Yoetze Halacha program that we had earlier this year, he's married to Tova Sinensky. We love that. And I've gotten to know Sinensky in the past couple years, and we're really happy that he's here tonight. So without further ado.
Thank you, Rabbi Das. I really appreciate it. Just before we get started, we have a nice intimate group, and I'm really excited to be with you guys. If we just go around, everyone can say your names. I'm probably going to forget. I'm not super fantastic at names, so maybe I'll say them again as we go, but at least I have some semblance. I'm going to go around this way.
Ken.
Nice. Doug.
Alana.
Ben.
Got it.
Elizabeth.
Maddie.
Parker.
Rebecca.
Benji.
You, I know. Hafter, once upon a time. I might have been her teacher. Okay.
He also
first Gemara teacher.
He also taught at Hafter once upon a time.
Once upon a time. Man, it feels like so many lifetimes ago. We were there together. Well, you too. Oh my gosh. Total blast from the past action. Good, guys. I'm so excited to be here, and I want to share with you a little bit about why I'm super excited to be here. When I heard about the idea of this program from Rabbi Talbis, I was incredibly excited. He mentioned that this is a group of students who have come together really through your own initiative, come together a diverse group, right? Maybe one student or two students. There's another one who's also involved. It's amazing to be here with us tonight. But really took the initiative and said, let's get something together and let's see what we can accomplish together as a group. And I think that that's so profound, not only on your part, Rebecca, but really on all of your parts. And here we are, and you're just on the cusp of getting ready for finals and the end of the semester. And if memory serves from my undergraduate days, it's a little bit of a hectic time for you guys, and it takes a tremendous amount of commitment. And I really believe that the college years are really the time when, first and foremost, or perhaps beyond any other point previously in our own experiences and in our own evolution as people, where we really take full responsibility for our own religious commitments, for our own priorities, and say, now we're out of the house, we're doing this on our own, and we're not on some of those who are on gap year programs or the like, not in the context of some formal program. I'm out on the college campus world, on that scene, on my own, and I'm going to make certain commitments, I'm going to set certain priorities, and that process of taking ownership over our own learning, over our own growth, is something that I think you guys have exemplified beautifully by committing yourselves to this project. I understand it's planning to continue next year, so those who are not graduating, so you'll have that opportunity, and those who are graduating can take pride that you've started something, and you're building something that's going to continue, and God willing, be a legacy for your fellow classmates. So I think this speaks so profoundly about you as individuals, about you as a Penn Hillel community, and I think it's a beautiful thing, and I find myself inspired to be with a group of people who have really taken their Judaism and made it their own in a beautiful way, and for that, I feel blessed to be here learning together with you guys. At the same time, you guys are also blessed to have incredible leadership and rabbinic leadership educators here. I don't know all the educators, but I happen to know you. I happen to know your wife. You guys have come to Kohelet. We've had the opportunity to host both of you and speak to our students, and they've responded really positively. And that idea of building bridges, Lower Merion's not too far away. So you guys have any friends with the community? Are you from the community? Is that
Elizabeth Dunoff?
Okay, got it. I gotcha. Okay, it all comes together. Good. Got it, 100%. So, Elizabeth can tell you that it's a wonderful community, and we're really proud of the work that all the institutions in the community are doing, but Kohelet among them. We have a really robust community education program, so if you ever are on what's called yutorah.org, is anyone familiar with that? They have audio archives of tons of Torah classes. So we have a page there. You can go check it out. God willing, with a new website on the way in like a number of months. I don't know how many months. They say 2 months. That means it's going to be, you know, 6 to 10. So who knows? We're starting construction on the school. It's the same set of rules that are in place. But check them out if you guys are traveling anywhere. If you just want some quasi-local Torah that's really that's cutting edge, that's not afraid to engage with real relevant issues, check it out. And I'd love your feedback on all the stuff that we have there. You guys have completed the study of Megillat Esther. And what I wanted to do with you is spend a few minutes this evening hearing from you, engaging in a conversation, and sharing some of my own thoughts. And what I'd like to do is to do this in two parts. I'm going to be sharing a thesis, and I want to give one example, one instance of that thesis, kind of discuss it together. And I think it's a thesis that really, if we were to trace it properly through Megillat Esther, this is assumed. So I wanted to share something that allows us to delve into some texts, as you guys have been learning through the Shoresh program, and at the same time touches on sort of a larger motif, a meta theme that runs throughout Megillat Esther, and to have the opportunity to, for you, to kind of see one instance as a case study for a larger idea. Let me start actually by giving you some sense as to my thesis, and then we'll share a little bit about how I think, where we see that in one particular narrative here in the story of Megillat Esther. So toward of the Megillah, we have the following phrase. It says that Divrei, Megillah is described as, these words were transcribed, Divrei Shalom. Can you finish the phrase? Yeah. Divrei Shalom. Ve'emet. Words of peace and truth. And the question is, what does that mean? What are words of peace and truth? And I want to share with you a thesis. I'm stealing it. I'm kind of lifting it from a number of authors. One of my favorites is Dr. Norman Lamb. Is that a familiar name to people? Dr. Norman Lamb, unbiased in favor, because he might be related to my wife. But I love having the pleasure of quoting him. And I saw this for the first time. He suggested this idea. It's the most poorly photocopied source that you have, text that you have here. They published a couple years ago, Rabbi Lamb, when he was a rabbi in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, delivered decades of sermons. Every Saturday night, he would sit down and he would carve out time in his schedule and he would transcribe the final version of his sermons. And he did this over the course of between 800 and 1,000 sermons that he delivered over the course of Shabbat and the various holidays of the Jewish year. And when you do that for a lifetime and you live in a time and place where people actually want to sit for more than 4 minutes long with the Dvar Torah, things used to be quite different in that regard. It's like 25 minutes, it looks like, each one, and he transcribed them. And so they took the raw material, they put it up on a website, and then they started to publish them essentially as books. And they published one on Megillat Esther, so you have the Megillah, you have a series of essays. It's actually really unbelievable. They also published in that context a series of essays from him, or sermons that he delivered around Yom HaShoah, Yom HaZikaron, and Yom HaAtzma'ut, which is the other side of the book. The impetus for that was primarily to have enough material to publish a respectable book, but while it's there, there's some amazing material. So if you happen to have it, I don't know if you have it in the library, but if anyone happens to have access to it, take a look. It's something like, I should know this, right? Mystery and Majesty, or maybe the other way, Majesty and Mystery, I forget which way around. But on the other side, you go from the English side, you see some of those sermons, so feel free to take a look. And he picks up on this phrase, and he suggests essentially that this phrase is a key to the meaning of the Megillah. So he says, start from the new paragraph, begins on the last side of the source sheet. How does one account for this paradox? In other words, there's an apparent paradox in terms of the stature of Ahasuerus, this king. Is he wise? Is he foolish? Is he good? Is he bad? How do we understand his character? So he says, if Ahasuerus is really a non-entity, why does everything seem to revolve around him? The answer is that the Megillah, as a document promulgated by Mordechai and Esther, was of necessity addressed to two separate audiences. Primarily was written to and for their fellow Jews, both of that age and all ages. But secondarily, it was a document which had to satisfy, or at least not offend, Ahasuerus, his royal court, and especially the official religion of the empire. The Jews of Persia triumphed, they were victorious, but they could not afford to assert their independence as openly as were the Maccabees able to do in a later era. They were still in Galut, they were still in exile. Hence, the tale must be subdued. It must be written on two levels, revealed and concealed. Revealed and concealed, open and hidden, an outer and an inner story. And hence, in the words of Mordechai himself, the Megillah was sent to the Jewish communities of 127 provinces as Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, words of peace and truth. To the Jews, the story of the Megillah was a met truth, the real story, which they had to discover by a patient and careful perusal of the text. But the apparent story of the Megillah was not the same as the inner true story for purposes of shalom, peacefulness, and the desire not to offend the ruling circles and establish religion. In other words, the Megillah is an unusually splendid example of a diplomatic document which tries to accommodate the competing demands of shalom and emet. So this is a beautiful passage in its own right, and I thought it was worthwhile for itself. But this is a thesis that I'd like to think about a little bit together. You can, in your own time, consider the ways in which this dual level of meaning of the Megillah might run throughout the entirety of the text. How does it manifest itself with regard to this king, and how do we view his character? There are perhaps two levels. When we talk about the Mishta'ot, the different feasts, the parties that take place over the course of the story, what do they symbolize? Do they symbolize that which is grand, that which is majestic, or are they really about a bunch of people throwing a party and just having a good old time without any greater meaning? Is there anything of greater significance there? How are we to view some of the interesting characters in the Megillah that we don't necessarily know how to process or appreciate at first glance? And we think about it, we read through the Megillah, and all of a sudden becomes profoundly enlightened on the basis of this sort of dual-level reading, this split meaning of the Megillah. So what I want to do is to give just one instance. I don't even know if it's the best example, but it happens to be a really rich text and a well-known one, so I figured it would be a great opportunity for us to learn together. So if you go back to the beginning, as it were, and we read the story of Perek Gimel, the Megillah. Interestingly enough, one could make the argument that the first two chapters are kind of back, right? They're kind of background information. First, you have the feast, 127 days, right? 180 days and 7 days and so on, and then you have, right, the story with Vashti, and then you have all the introduction, the background to Mordechai and Esther, etc. But really, things begin in earnest with the third chapter, where Haman comes up with his decree. So there, we're going to read a little bit together. Anyone interested in doing a little bit of reading? Anyone, brave souls, jump in. Go ahead. Remind me your name again.
Benji.
Last name?
Dufus.
Benji Dukas, go ahead.
Do you want me to read?
Good. There's a trick they teach you, because I'm not great with names. So if you repeat the name back to the person, I might tend to remember better. So Benji Dukas. Yeah, that's a trick. So go ahead, Benji.
In Hebrew.
But now you know, not only do you know my tricks, but you can use that on anyone else. Go ahead, do it in Hebrew and English. Go ahead.
Okay.
If you're comfortable. Do you want to?
No, I can read them.
Whatever you prefer. All yours.
Acharat Rima Eleg, Yidal HaMelech Achashverosh, Et Haman Ben Hamdata HaGagi, V'naseyu V'yasem Et Kiso Me'al Kol HaSarim Asherito.
Good. You go over the English and go back and forth.
Sometime afterward, King Achashverosh promoted Haman, son of Hamdata, the Agagai. He advanced him and seated him higher than any of his fellow officials. V'chol Avdei HaMelech Asher B'shar HaMelech Korim Mishtachavim Laman, all the king's courtiers in the palace gate knelt and bowed low to Haman, for such was the king's order concerning him, but Mordechai would not kneel or bow low. Vayamru avdei hamelech asher b'shar hamelech l'mordechai madua ata obed et mitzvat hamelech. The king's courtiers who were in the palace gate said to Mordechai, why do you disobey the king's orders? Vayihi ke'amram elav yom vayom, V'lo shama lehem v'yagidu l'aman lirot ha'yamdu divrei Mordechai ki yigid lahem asher hu yudi. When they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordechai's resolves would prevail, for he had explained to them that he was a Jew. V'yar Haman ki in Mordechai kore mishtachaveh lo v'yimale Haman chema. When Haman saw that Mordechai would not kneel or bow low to him, Haman was filled with rage. V'yves beinav Lishloach Yabe Mordechai, Levado, ki yigidu lo et Am Mordechai, Bevakesh Haman, Lashmid, et Kol Hayudim Asher, Bechol Malchut, Achashverosh, Am Mordechai. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordechai alone. Having been told who Mordechai's people were, Haman plotted to do away with all the Jews, Mordechai's people, throughout the kingdom of Achashverosh.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Well done. Okay, so I wanted to raise two questions and to get your thoughts, and then we're going to go from there. First of all, what do you think motivated Mordechai to refuse to bow? You understand that? Why not?
Go ahead. I was going to say the midrash that I was taught was that Haman had like an idol around his neck, like a necklace or something on his clothing in some way, and so it mm-hmm. would be bowing to an idol.
Good, we're going to get there. Good. Do you see that in the texts? What do you think would motivate someone to suggest that he was wearing an idol around his neck?
Because there isn't actually a halachic prohibition against like sort of a formal courteous bow to like another person, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So they sort of had to come up with a reason why halacha mm-hmm. would forbid Mordechai from doing mm-hmm. what he should have maybe done.
Right, in other words, right. And what's the flip side? In other words, let's say Mordechai goes ahead and bows versus doesn't bow. What's the difference? Is it, right, what are the stakes here?
For Haman.
No, for Mordechai. What are the stakes for Mordechai? What happens when he opts?
Life and death.
For that?
Becomes life and death. He may not know that at that moment. But.
Great question, and we're not sure. There's a lot that we don't know. One of the things we don't know is how likely Mordechai would have been to anticipate this outcome. For himself, and not only for himself, but for his entire people. We really don't know, and that's part of the question. But the stakes are high. How well he would have known that or not is anyone's guess. We're not really sure. But potentially the outcome could be extremely negative on the other side. So there's good reason to think, you know what, maybe play this one safe. I mean, if there's no halachic issue, if there's no reason not to do this, so then maybe just play by the rules. He doesn't put his own life in danger, he doesn't put the life of his people in danger. Doesn't sound like a very good idea. So that suggestion that Elisheva had, so I would call that perhaps a religious... Elizabeth, excuse me. Right? Sorry. I call that a religious objection.
Is this before
right?
or after he overheard the people plotting to do the killing of the king?
Shortly after, and that's going to play in just a moment. So hold on
to
that.
You might have thought that Haman had something to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's hold that thought. Why would it be related to that, though?
Because if he thought, he just might have thought that Haman was a bad guy already, so then he wouldn't want to bow down to him.
Okay, but even if he thinks he's a bad guy, he still runs the risk. I mean, he's very powerful now. It seems foolish. Okay, so he's a good Jew, and it goes back thousands of years, right? So he's got gall, he's got chutzpah. Good, so some actually suggest something along those lines, that there was a personal element to this. Remember, Mordechai, not only did he have a negative encounter with Haman previously, but Mordechai had, what had he done for the king?
Saved
his life. What does Mordechai arguably think about his own status? Right?
He should be higher than Haman.
Okay, there is no king without me, some have suggested. I'm not sure this is the correct explanation. Some have said, maybe it's not motivated by religious reasons, maybe it's motivated by personal reasons. He felt that he had given the king his life. Why should I, Mordechai, who have accomplished something of such great significance, and the proof to the pudding is what happens later in the story. What does the king do for the one who saved his life?
Run around him.
Okay, right? He gives him the royal treatment. Right? Haman becomes incredibly jealous of him. So is it possible that there's a personal element in this as well? We're not sure.
Well, could it also be possible that because Haman is an Amalekite, that since the Jews are supposed to destroy the Amalekites, why would they bow down?
Excellent, good. So you guys have covered all the interpretations, right? You guys are good, right? Maybe we said it's personal or political. Maybe it's religious, right? That's what I suggested earlier. Or maybe it's related to religion, obviously, but maybe what I would call national, right? In other words, it's not about idolatry. It's not about the religious objectionableness, as it were, of the nature of the act of bowing before the second to the king. It's more about the negative and complex relationship between the Jew and the Amalekite, between the Israelites and the Amalekite. Maybe for someone else, he would have gone ahead and bowed. That's very different than the religious explanation. It doesn't matter who's wearing the idol. If you're wearing an idol and you're claiming to represent a different deity, so then I'm not allowed to bow down to you. So clearly that's a very different kind of thing. So what's interesting is that all of these suggestions are offered by the commentaries, both traditional and modern as well. So for example, right, by the way, I gave you. There's a great. We're not doing it this way, but there's a great tradition of artwork depicting Mordechai's refusal to bow down to Haman. This is a 19th century French depiction. It's the artist spent some time in Odessa, and so there are some sort of Oriental themes, Eastern themes that he incorporates as well. You kind of get, you see just how blatant it is in this depiction. One of the really interesting things that's been pointed out, just as an aside, is that it's not entirely obvious that Mordechai was himself so obvious about this. Right? In other words, if you look back at the text, actually interesting, it says, right, if you take a look at source 3, the servants of the king say to Mordechai, why are you violating the commandments of the king? And he refuses to listen. Mordechai doesn't bow down. And then in number 4, in Pasuk 4, Vayagidu Haman, they tell Haman, Lirota Yamdu Devei Mordechai Ki Gidal Ham Yehudi, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordechai's resolve would prevail. Which implies that, was it evident or not evident at the outset to Haman? Not evident. Isn't this interesting? I always, when I think about this story, I envision this, right? Exactly this picture. Everyone else is right there and they're all bowing and it's this obvious thing. And Mordechai blatantly disregards, publicly rebukes the second to the king, says, I'm not bowing. And that's not quite how it happened, interestingly enough. Does not mean it was unintentional. It presumably was intentional, but we think of Mordechai as having been so sort of, and so rebellious in a way, then so dismissive of Haman and his behavior. Maybe it wasn't quite that way, and maybe he had the awareness that maybe he should be more subtle about this. Maybe it could be dangerous. Maybe it wasn't the best idea to do so in such a public way, and yet it still goes that far.
And I wonder how the not related to his Jewish identity, whether it's national or religious, because it says, at least in the text, it says he explained to them that he was, it seems at least publicly, he's saying that he can't do this. Identity.
Right. They're deducing that that's the case. What it doesn't say is that Mordechai himself had been motivated by that. There are all sorts of scenarios in which I'm acting in a certain kind of way. People know one strand of information. So what they do is they jump to the most obvious of conclusions. Quite possible that that's the reason. But it's plausible that while he was motivated by something else, they took the one piece of information that they had about him and they arrived at that conclusion, even if that's not the motivating factor of it.
I think the reason we always had that vision of it like kind of being this refusal, you're under just that yom every day. I think so, when we're younger, it doesn't contradict what you said,
right.
But I think that's kind of when our minds, like every day he came and every day he just stood there, exactly, getting back on him.
And I think it's true that he, even as they urge him to go ahead and do this, he does refuse, and that's where it begins to blow up. I'm just pointing out, at least at its inception, it's in the first stage, it's not that motivation, but that's absolutely right. By the way, there's a scholar named Michael Fox who wrote a commentary on Esther, and he makes exactly this point. He says, we are to picture him wafting through the crowd. This is Haman initially, seeing only the adulation he is receiving, noticing no one else, no one individually. Not even the one person who, as everyone else sees, remains unbowed and thus most conspicuous. So this is just that he's picking up on exactly this point, and maybe there's some commentary on Haman. He thinks he's all that, but he's actually so far above his audience that he just even see what's actually going on right beneath his eyes.
Just a clarification question. According to Jewish law, are people allowed to bow to other people?
Yeah, it's a great question. We're going to come to some sources. There's reason to think that what we heard earlier is accurate. In other words, that there are many instances, even in Chumash and throughout the Bible, in which you see individuals bowing down before kings without any hesitation. With Yosef and many other instances. To Gentile. So it would seem to indicate that this is different. There are some who suggest that bowing is different than prostrating.
right, like it's a full-on.
That this is korea u'mishtachave. If you look at the Hebrew, it says to bow and prostrate. So that might be sort of, right, the full, right, throwing yourself fully on the floor might, right, like one of the, in the picture, one of them is kind of partly prostrated and the other one is fully prostrated. There might be a difference between more of sort of just showing respect and full-out prostration. We don't know. There's good reason to think that the only reason he was there is because he had a privileged position, and so there's good reason to think that that was an unusual, even rare position for a Jew to have. So we don't know for sure, but it seems to be a reasonable guess that this was a relatively unusual kind of position for a Jew to be in.
The thing you were saying with the people in the Bible being depicted as bowing, even if they were bowing, does that automatically mean it's okay, since, I mean, other characters in the Bible clearly did things that we don't consider okay, so...
Right. It's a great question, and it's possible. I don't know of any instance in which it says that someone prostrated before a king, and the Bible says, and he did the right thing. It doesn't announce it in that way. At the same time, if you have that as a consistent pattern throughout, it kind of seems like you would have thought that somewhere along the way someone would kind of raise their hand and say, wait a second, how'd you do that? And the truth is that the commentaries actually address this. It's already in the Talmud. The Talmud itself says that if it's mi'ava u mi'ira, that if it's motivated by love or fear, reverence, rather than seeing the king as a deity, that that's considered to be different, and that actually that would have been permissible. And that's what motivates the Talmud Kabbalah's interpretation. So it would seem that the simple thrust of Chumash and the way that the rabbis generally understood it was that that would have been otherwise permissible, and that's exactly what motivated this reinterpretation. What's interesting, if you take a look at the commentaries that I gave you starting at source 4, you'll see some of these pieces. Source 4 gave you an unusual midrash, which I saw cited in this context. The midrash suggests, comes up with this narrative. I don't know what the textual basis is. I don't know fully what motivated it. But it imagines this conversation, whether literal or figurative, between Mordechai and Haman, in which essentially Haman wants to borrow money from Mordechai, and ultimately, as part of the sale, strangely enough, actually sells himself as a servant, for some period of time at least, to Mordechai until the loan is repaid, which is an unusual kind of arrangement. And what's interesting about this midrash is that it has been cited in suggesting, in supporting the first interpretation, which I'm calling the personal one. So we suggested earlier that maybe what motivated a personal decision on the part of Mordechai would have been the fact that he thought he was worthy. He was the one who saved the king's life. He was the one who would be, right, who would be riding around town on the king's horse, dressed up in his regalia and all of that. This is another midrash which seems to indicate that although right now Haman is superior in rank to Mordechai, in fact at one point it was reversed. So is that a possible interpretation? I happen to think that the personal interpretation is the least plausible, is the least likely interpretation of this text, but it's out there and has been offered. Rashi, the great medieval scholar, in his commentary to Ar Pasuk, cites the rabbinic interpretation that Haman had made himself out to be a god. So in source 5 he says, read the Hebrew and the English, Asatzmo Eloka, Lefichach Umarchai Lo Yichrav Lo Yishtachaveh, he had made himself a god. Therefore, Mordechai would not bow and would not prostrate. There are two rabbinic versions of this idea. The way that Rashi says it, essentially, Haman had made himself into a god. There's another view that's out there, which is cited, it's out of order for some reason on the sheet. I thought I was to go to source 10. No. Source. I give it to you? Is there a Tosafot in here somewhere? Second. Thank you. No problem. Oh, maybe I didn't put it on the sheet. Okay. There's a Tosafot who actually suggests that it's not that Haman made himself into a deity, but rather he wore some sort of symbol around his neck. And that's the assertion. Others push back and say that that's actually anachronistic, that it wasn't historically, that that wasn't how the Persians acted. That's something that Christians did much later on, but that's in a medieval context, but that's Persians didn't believe in that. They didn't wear icons. They were actually opposed to iconology, so that's iconography, so that would be perhaps historically questionable, but that's another suggestion that is offered. If you take a look at source 6, I gave you another contemporary scholar, Professor Bush, who suggests the third interpretation, that it was more of his Jewishness, the Jewish, the Israelite, Amalekite kind of mention. It says both the way in which the narrative takes for granted that it relates to Mordechai's Jewishness and the absence of any other reasonable explanation gives great credence to the view that the narrator assumed his readers would recognize the tribal and racial enmity between Israel and Amalek implied by the patronymics of the two men. Patronymics, lineage, in other words, of the two, their family lines, and that's what motivated the behavior on their part. So the first question that we raised is the motivation. We saw three interpretations. Can you prove one way or the other for sure? It's kind of, you can make arguments, but notice the absence of any clarity. That's one way in which fundamentally there's an open question that's unresolved if we look at the text on the surface, right? That's question one. Question number two, and here's maybe even more of a kicker. What do you think? Was Mordechai's behavior justified? The second question that I wanted to pose. Was it justified? Do you think he did the right thing? Do you think he did the wrong thing? What do you guys say?
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Yeah,
why are they both so ambiguous? Source 4 and 5.
Uh-huh.
You can't really, you don't know what's happening or who he is until you get to the end and you backtrack. Out.
Well, source 4, the truth is I gave you a smaller excerpt of a longer midrash that takes quite some time. So to get the fuller context, you want to read the entire midrash. I'm happy to share it with you. But it's really because I kind of took a snippet out of it and took a little bit out of context, so that's on me. But source number 5, Rashi gives you, he's really citing the Talmud, essentially. Talmud says he made himself into a god, or that's Rashi's spin on a line in the Talmud. So that's really also, he's just dealing with the limited evidence that he has. So Rashi explains that presumably he made himself a god. Excuse me, the other details are not really necessary. Rashi's not telling us the whole story. He's just explaining narrowly, why in the world would Mordechai refuse to bow to him? It seems so foolish and counterproductive. Must be that he had made himself a god, and therefore, religiously, as a committed monotheistic Jew, this is just something that he couldn't bring himself to.
But
do
why not use more pronouns and know who he mm-hmm. is in all of these?
He's commenting on the verse.
So it's like, you assume you read the verse, and then you're looking at the commentary.
Yep. Excellent. Okay, great. What do you guys think? What would you do?
I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with the maybe initial reading we have of the religious justification, only because I don't know if I would bow to someone who says that they're a god, even if they force me to. It just feels like such a contradiction to the most fundamental tenet of monotheism in Judaism. Whereas if you're talking about more of a, he calls it the patronymics.
Yep.
I guess that's a, I don't want to say it's not justifiable, but it makes it more of like a racial sort of irreconcilable hatred, and that might be a little more problematic.
It's more complex. Although there's a religious component there as well, because obviously the Amalek piece
is
complex in its own right, but that's clearly in the backdrop here. So maybe he understands it better, maybe he understands it less, but there is a religious component to that as well. But that's definitely part of that. Okay, good. Other thoughts, other responses?
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. Did he do the right thing or the wrong thing?
When he didn't bow.
When he refused to bow.
I mean, I think if the risk is this great of, like, not only his life, but the life of his entire people at stake, it feels to me like it's not so clear whether it's justifiable. I don't want to say that it's not and, like, come down hard, but it doesn't feel like to me like it's an obvious, he did the right thing.
It's a morally ambiguous situation.
Yeah.
And the text doesn't say. It leaves it morally ambiguous, which is, I think, part of where we're going to go.
Are we kind of given the like situation that the Jews are in at the beginning? Because like at the end, the Jews are on top. Like from all like the outcome of all this was that now the Jews are in a lot more power than they used to be. So like in that sense, perhaps justify it if like he really thought like all this through and like he knew that the Jews would end up on top.
So he couldn't have predicted all of that unless he was a prophet, which Rabbi suggests he was, but that's not the face reading of the story. You know what's interesting it doesn't say it explicitly, but between the lines, when the Jews are invited to the feast and are considered, you know, it's interesting that Jews in Persia were specifically treated relatively well. I don't say that they were treated to the equivalent of the pagans at that time, but they were treated with relative respect. Remember that there's an incident in which King Cyrus is the one who actually initiates the call for the Jews to return to Jerusalem from the Babylonian exile and from the Persian exile. That's a Persian, the first Persian emperor who rises to power, immediately calls upon the Jews to be restored to their own homeland. The Persians had a policy of religious tolerance that was more generous than, not all, but many of the Babylonian emperors. So it was a relatively open environment. At the same time, clearly Esther is hiding her identity to some degree, one way or another, that's part of it. So it's clearly more complex. So it seems that the Jews had a relatively secure position, but things weren't perfect, and behind the scenes there was always the possibility of anti-Semitism once again rearing its ugly head. That's how I would say it. So it's interesting. The rabbis themselves grappled with this issue. I would say the overwhelming majority of commentaries, including the rabbinic commentaries, view Mordechai's behavior positively. I think that's the, and in my opinion, as you'll see, I think that's the more compelling view. But for now, I'm just sharing with you that many commentators say that. So I gave you one example in Source 7. So this is a midrash. So this midrash reads as follows. It says, "For as long as I am with them, they do not assume a bad name." So this is God saying, as long as I am with the Jews, things don't go too badly with them, for them. So it says, "In Egypt I was with them, with the Jewish people, and the nation was found to be whole. As it is written, an enclosed garden is my sister, my bride." So the Jews in Egypt are compared to the bride of God, even though, let's be honest, they were shalem, they were whole, they weren't really perfect. The Jews were far from being pure monotheists at the story, time of the story of Egypt. There's reason to think that they had idolatrous tendencies. It was much more complicated than that, but fundamentally there was a certain kind of basic commitment that the Jews had when they shed the blood and all of that. So there's a sense that they truly love God, and that metaphor is invoked. "In Babylon I was with them, and the nation was found to be whole, as it is written, for if it's so, it must be, our God whom we serve." And it says, "In Mede," that's in other words in Persia at this time, "I was with them, and the nation was found to be whole, as it is written." What's the proof text? Right? Mordechai did not bow, nor did he prostrate himself. So in other words, this midrash is an instance in which the rabbis are invoking Mordechai's refusal to bow as a sign of what? As a sign of, right, of their commitment, of their wholeness, even in exile, even when we're dispersed among the different nations, we remain, right, with our integrity, and we continue to be committed. Interestingly enough, just to move things along a little bit, although it's true that this is the majority view, there are indications in the Talmud itself that there's a question to be asked about Mordechai's behavior. So the Midrash tells us in the name of Rava, one of the scholars at the time of the Talmud, in Source 8, "The congregation of Israel at the time said this from the opposite perspective." The context is beside the point right now. "Not as a boast, but as a complaint." So they're talking about, about to invoke a particular pasuk, a particular verse, and use it to be critical. So of whom are they critical? What's the verse? It says in the Navi, "See what a Judean has done to me, and how a Benjaminite has repaid me." All right, so then it says like this. So what a Jan has done to me is referring to the responsibilities of Judah. As David did not kill Shimei. Anyone know who Shimei was? Shimei ben the son of Gera. Anyone know what he did in the story in the book of Shmuel?
He cursed
the king. Okay, he curses King David. And King David, toward the very end of his life, specifically issues a command, don't kill Shimei. And there's a question whether or not it was the right thing. And this particular passage is asked, it was a mistake. Although he was liable to the death penalty, the grave consequences of this failure included that Mordechai was born from him, and it was he against whom Haman was jealous, leading Haman to issue a decree against all of the Jewish people. Whoa. So the rabbis are being critical of King David. They're saying that descended from King David was Mordechai, and that was the consequence. That was, in other words, the punishment. That's a shocking statement.
Sorry, who are we saying that Mordechai was descended from? From David or from Shimei?
from David. Yeah, no. And that's the criticism. All right, and then there's another example, and they say the other one is a reference to a Benjaminite who sinned. And Benjaminite was King Saul, who did not kill off the people of Amalek, which spawned, right? Okay. Right, ultimately Haman. So this is viewed as going all the way back to these sort of primal sins on the part of the Jewish people. One results in the birth of Haman, and the other one in the birth of Mordechai, because of whom the entirety of the Jewish people was endangered. Which implies what kind of attitude toward his refusal to bow? All right, it seems like an implicit criticism. It's a very negative association. It's a stunning comment in the Talmud. I don't think it's the primary view, in other words, the majority view. Most of the Midrashim, most of the sources in the rabbinic literature seem supportive of Mordechai's behavior, but you see a little bit of the criticism here in this passage. Question?
No, I don't. I guess I...
Comment?
Yeah,
suggestion.
I guess it doesn't sit well with me, this particular reading.
Go ahead.
In that it feels like it's taking away like the agency and like responsibility of Haman for his actions, and it's just like, well, this was inevitable, it was just a punishment.
Sure.
But Haman is very much at fault here, and his reaction, I think, like, deserves our condemnation. And,
right. I agree, because you could use this to justify other acts that are atrocious in nature and say, well, it was destined to happen and we can't fight against it, and where's the responsibility for acting in free will? That's a great question. It's a larger question also. It comes up in a lot of contexts, so that's a wider discussion, but it's a fair point. So what emerges, though, I think, from the text is what I would say, a lot of different possible interpretations, but I would say both the motivations and the judgments of Mordechai's behavior are left open. We've given a range of different explanations for why he did what he did. We've given different interpretations, readings of the text in terms of whether he was justified in what we did. And yet the text leaves it open and leaves Mordechai open to the possibility of criticism, which is, I think, a fascinating kind of observation. And just to add to this, there's one more comment in the Megillah which Mordechai gets accolades throughout most of the Megillah. Let's put this in context. He comes out extremely well throughout the overwhelming majority of the Megillah. He does quite well for himself, and he's revered. He's considered to be an incredibly positive character overall. There's no question about that. There's one other place where there's maybe a hint of a question about him. Anyone know what I'm referring to? It's toward the very end of the Megillah. Yeah. So Rabbi Talbot says, Rove. What do we mean by rove? The majority. So take a look at the end on page 6, source 12, and it describes, the Megillah concludes its description of Mordechai. So this is, right, it's toward the very end of source 12. So it says Hebrew and English, Ki Mordechai Yehudi Mishalem Echad Chashrosh V'Gadol La'Yehudim V'Ratzui L'Rov Echav D'Reish Tov L'Amo V'Daver Shalom L'Chol Zaro. Mordechai the Jew is ranked as the very conclusion of the Megillah. This is it. Mordechai the Jew ranked next to King Achashverosh, was highly regarded by the Jews and popular with... Okay, so here, this is Sfaria. Anyone use Sfaria? Yes, Sfaria fans? I'm a huge Sfaria fan. Those who use Sfaria.org. So, my students tell me I'm the record source sheet holder on Sfaria.org. So, Sfaria Chashu. So you have to put that, take out everything else from the bio and just throw that in. That's what my students think.
Works for them, we should
kind of... What? Tell them.
Palmer works for
them. Okay, there you go.
We'll drive you.
Tell them. Ask them if it's true.
They
ask
should,
them
like,
confirm.
Have an award for you.
What? Guinness? Okay. There you go. Yeah, we need a ceremony. Okay, so it's interesting. So here, so Sfaria, which, by the way, the English translation of the Bible, I believe, is straight JPS. So JPS translates the multitude of his brethren. He was beloved among so many, but another interpretation that many commentaries and many scholars maintain is that it wasn't that he was beloved to the multitude of his brethren, but rather to the majority of his brethren. So imagine the end of the Megillah. We're trumpeting Mordechai and we're saying, oh, he was incredible. What an individual. And this is the captain of the Megillah. He was beloved to most of the Jews of his generation. Like, What? That's the compliment? That's the close? That's the greater... If it's the multitude, then great. But if it's the majority, it's a little strange. And again, the Talmud picks up on this and suggested that the rabbis of his generation critiqued him, that he abandoned the highest court of Jewish love, the Sanhedrin, and he wasn't serving. Maybe he shouldn't have served in the government. Maybe he should have continued to focus on the internal needs of the Jewish community. Questions that are raised about another one of his fundamental decisions over the course of his time in the Megillah. So this is, I think, troubling. It raises a basic question. Mordechai looks so good, and yet there's this incident that we often think of as heroic, but it's actually morally ambiguous. His motivations are unclear. The judgment of his proper judgment of his actions itself is left open. The very conclusion of the Megillah, which seems to highlight his greatness, seems to undercut him. Which one is it? Was Mordechai great, or was he not great? How are we to understand this? And what I'd like to suggest is, in essence, is that this goes to the heart of our discussion. That the Megillah is perhaps, this is one plausible interpretation, that the Megillah is operating on two different levels. Right? There's great reason to think that Mordechai is a wonderful and outstanding and heroic individual. But perhaps the Megillah intentionally plays him down a little bit. Why would you want to play him down? Because if you play up Mordechai too much, and you play up Esther too much, and give it the same share about Esther and some of her behaviors, if you play them up too much, what happens? You run the risk of, right, of playing who down? Right, the king. They are a second in command, be a second in command to the king. Mordechai gets too little credit. It's not a credible story. He gets too much credit, and you begin to raise questions about the real balance of power. You're close to the Megillah, you want to say great things about him, but you also want to say, well, he was the second to the king, and he was a great man, but he wasn't a perfect man. Even as the Jews know, one might suggest, according with the Rabbi Lam, wink, wink. He was a wonderful individual. He was a heroic Jew, maybe not perfect. They were critical of him, there's no question, but he was, on balance, a hero. But for the sake of the politics of telling the story in ancient Persia, it was extremely important to present it in a way that wouldn't build him up all too much. Truth is, you can strengthen this idea. There's evidence, we're not going to go through all of it now, but I'll mention it very quickly and brief, that there are, I know you guys are all in study mode, so I'm going to keep you guys out too late, but very quickly, there are three other episodes in Tanakh, in the Bible, that are alluded to quite clearly in our story, the third chapter of Megillah. Any other stories this evokes or reminds you of?
What part reminds us of?
The story of Haman and Ahasuerus, the story that we've been studying. Does it remind us of anything else?
Joseph.
Hmm? Okay, Yosef is going to be one. Excellent. Okay, all right.
Daniel.
Unanimity. Daniel is number two. Excellent. Very good. A third one is a trick question. What in Tanakh? That's a good hint. What in Tanakh? Where else, somewhere in Tanakh? You don't have to go too far. Making it a better hint. Where in Esther, exactly. Where in Esther do we have parallels to the story?
Is that Vashti?
Okay. There are multiple parallels, and I think they're intentional, and they're very clear-cut. Let's go in exactly the order of the ones that you suggested, and I'll give you the quick version of this. Number one, the parallels to Yosef, the story in which, in particular, there are many, many, many similarities between the story of Megillat Esther and Yosef. There's similarity in Mordechai and Yosef, similarities between Esther and Yosef. That's a whole shiur in its own right, but they're definitely out there. But what's more is that there's a particular phrase that appears here with regard to Mordechai's refusal to bow to Haman that appears almost verbatim in the story with regard to Yosef, and I refer specifically to the story in which Yosef is propositioned by the wife of Potiphar and refuses to lie together with her. And it says, "Vayhi ke'amram ilav yom v'yom v'lo shema aleihem," that as she said this every single day to him, day in, day out, she tried to seduce Joseph, who was working for her, for the master of the house, and he refuses. And it's almost identical to the language that you have here in our story, right, where it says that at the beginning of verse 4, "Vayhi ke'amram ilav yom v'yom," which we read earlier, when they spoke to him day after day. It's almost the exact same language, almost as if to imply Mordechai is a modern-day Yosef figure. Let me ask you, did Yosef do the right thing?
Yes.
Absolutely. So that's not a question in the text. So that reference seems to buttress the view that Mordechai is acting heroically, he's acting properly. Number two, the story of Daniel, the book of Daniel. In the third chapter of Daniel, there's a whole story in which the king essentially puts out, Nebuchadnezzar puts out an idol, Babylonian king, and demands that all the people bow down to it. Three Jews refuse to bow down. It's in Aramaic, so it's a little bit hard to get through. Essentially, you see in the English as well, if you want, and it's really striking that it's essentially the same story. They refuse to bow down. In that case, what does he do? He tosses them into a furnace, right? They're not burnt alive, and they survive miraculously. And again, there are also textual similarities. Again, because it's Aramaic, not Hebrew, it's not exactly identical, but there are, again, a lot of parallels between the two stories. And I ask again, those individuals who refused to bow before Nebuchadnezzar's idols, were they to be viewed as sinners or as heroes? Correctly or incorrectly? Clearly, God bless. Clearly in that story, they're acting appropriately. In fact, they emerge unscathed. There's a miracle that's performed on their behalf. It's the opposite of Megillah. In the Megillah, what happens is all the Jews are nearly condemned to death. But in Daniel, right, there's a miracle, so they emerge unscathed. So that's number two. Again, would seem to imply, based on the parallels, that it's to be viewed favorably. And then the third one was the story of Vashti. Striking similarities. There are also textual similarities we don't have time to get into right now. But also highly similar kind of scenario, right? A very powerful royal official demands that a person perform an act in which that individual demonstrates obedience to the king and his court. That individual is refused, and there is a threat of death to that individual, right, or some sort of harsh punishment. It's not 100% explicit that Vashti dies, but that's a different shear. But either way, clearly something terrible is going to be deposed at minimum from her position, if not actually executed. And then the punishment is broadened in Vashti's case from just her to whom? Which population is targeted?
All the ladies,
yeah, all the women. It's a misogynistic decree, it would appear. And right, all the men are masters in their own home. Of course, the Megillah is undercutting that. So that's not the positive message in the Megillah. It's actually ironic. But there's a broadening that takes place. And here as well, what happens? It's not just Mordechai who's targeted on the basis of his betrayal, but rather what happens? Right, it's brought into the entire population. And there again, did Vashti do the right thing or the wrong thing? What do you think? What's your sense of it? So we could argue it, but it sounds like my impression of that story was that she was presumably justified. And even if we're critical of Vashti in other regards, which the rabbis in certain ways were, it's still, you get the sense that she did the right thing. So again, I think what's stunning is exactly this. If you read our story on the surface, you don't know. But if you look at the biblical parallels, you connect it to Joseph, you connect it to Daniel, connect it to other Hebrew texts, which the Persians couldn't read directly anyway. So they could get something in translation, but they wouldn't pick up on the intertextual allusions within the Megillah proper. All of a sudden, the Jews start to connect the dots, and they say, aha, Mordechai really is the hero. But for the sake of the politics of this, we need to keep it on the sort of on the DL, and we need to keep it subtle. This pattern continues consistently. This is just one example. But you have this, I would argue, throughout the Megillah in a number of different contexts, again, about the Mishta'ot and about Esther and in all sorts of cases. But I just wanted to give you this one example. If you take a look, by the way, the end of the Megillah, I think, demonstrates this further. So, for example, the end of the Megillah has Ahasuerus issuing what?
Tax.
How do you interpret that? You know what they do in synagogues sometimes now? You ever hear this? You know how like they bang every time you say Haman? So there's a joke. Did you get through here? What happened here?
No, I mentioned
okay.
It last week.
Oh, you mentioned it. Okay, yeah. There you go. That was a brush that came so glad.
Yeah,
I will say, I'm about to say it right now.
Rabbi.
Oh, I don't know if I can say it as well. But no, but they continue to bang. When it says that he placed a tax upon the people, that people bang just like they did for Haman. Because, you know, in a democratic society, you know, everyone's against taxes like that. So it's a joke, although I think there's a profound commentary on the Jewish community, I think, of that. But that's a separate sociological set of observations I'm happy to share in a different context. But I think part of what's happening here is that same ambiguity. Ahasuerus reads that. What does he say? That at the Megillah, who's large and in charge? Right? It's me. Right? The Megillah, how does it begin? with Achashverosh and his great wealth and his parties and so on and so forth. He's in charge. How does it end? Well, right, he's in charge of the finances. And even Esther and Mordechai, they're only empowered because they're second to the king. And even Mordechai, who might have been the closest rival to the king, the majority of his brethren, not all of them. So again, playing exactly this game, but if you don't read the Megillah carefully, you just take it on the surface level. So that's Divrei Shalom in Rabbi Lam's words. That's the words of peace. That's the political element of the document. And so you open it up, and it looks like it's very complimentary, but really down deep, it's much more subtle and much more complex than that. And this is not a new thesis that Dr. Lam came up with. This is credited in particular to a great scholar from the University of Chicago named Professor Leo Strauss. If you take a look at source 14, page 7, I gave you an excerpt. This started as an article entitled Persecution, the Art of Writing, and then he broadened it to a book, and he classically extended this thesis to the writing of Maimonides and the Guide to the Perplexed and his Moran Bukhim, to the writing, interestingly enough, of the Kuzari. Those who have read Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's philosophical classic, he applies it to the writings of Plato. It's a very broad thesis. The book actually goes through each of these instances. And this is Leo Strauss's theory, Persecution, the Art of Writing, the notion of a political document. Persecution, he writes, I just took one excerpt, gives rise to a peculiar technique of writing, and therewith to a peculiar type of literature, in which the truth about all crucial things is presented exclusively between the lines. That literature is addressed not to all readers, but to trustworthy and intelligent readers only, like those at this table right now. That is all the advantages of private communication without having its greatest disadvantage, that it reaches only personal acquaintances. That is all the advantages of public communication without having its greatest disadvantage, capital punishment, for the author. But how can a man perform the miracle of speaking in a publication to a minority while being silent to the majority of his readers? Experience and reasoning show that what seems to be a miracle is perfectly natural. The fact which makes this literature possible can be expressed in the axiom that thoughtless men are careless readers, and only thoughtful men are careful readers. Therefore, an author who wishes to address only thoughtful men has but to write in such a way that only a very careful reader can detect the meaning of his book. This is a little bit of a dismissive way of relating to much of his readership, and I don't think of it in quite that way, but I think there is still a profound truth that he gets at, that very often in writing we're talking on two levels, and I think the Megillah could potentially be added to Strauss's list of these two-tiered documents as Rabbi Lam develops. And I think that this is a profound idea not only about the Megillah, and I think as you continue, after you guys finish finals, you guys want to circle back to Megillat Esther to think about it. I do think it manifests itself in many other contexts, but I think it's relevant to our everyday lives as well. I think much of our lives is not only in terms of obviously our writing, but in terms of the way that we live every day and that we relate to our peers, I think this is really a very relevant idea as well. The Rei Shalom Ve'emet, that we exist on two levels. That we sometimes in our interactions with our friends, sometimes we want to be frank, right? We see concerning behavior on the part of someone that we care about. We want to say something. On the other hand, that's Divrei Emet. I want to be straight with you because I really care about you. At the same time, sometimes wisdom is, you know what, Divrei Shalom. This might not be the best time to confront my friend about something I really care about. We often grapple with this. Do we say something? Do we not say something? Do we confront someone about something? Do we stand up against something? Or do we say, you know what, this is not the time to stand up. I'm going to find the best opportunity to really stand up and make my opinion heard. And we struggle with this. And I think we struggle with it to ourselves. Sometimes there are things about ourselves and we look in the mirror and we look deep within and we say, you know what, that's something I'm not really ready to tackle right now. And Divrei Shalom, I'll come to that, you know, at a later point when I'm really ready to grapple with that issue. But there are other times when we look in the mirror and say, you know what, Divrei Emet, there's something I really need to work on. There's some way, something I've identified myself about myself that really needs to be addressed and it really needs to be addressed right now. So my blessing to all of us, and I certainly include myself in this as well, is that we should strike this balance not only in our writing and only in our study, but in our own lives. Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, we should have the wisdom both with others, with our peers, with our friends, with our loved ones, but also with ourselves to know how to strike that balance. And God willing, by taking that lesson of the Megillah and applying it to our own lives, we should be successful in integrating this profound message of Megillat Esther of Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Guys, pleasure learning together. Wish you much continued success, and God willing, get to learn together in the future. And Bahatzlacha with everything. Pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.